ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Business, big and small, is shaping our economy, our present and our future. But it's a loud and busy world out there, and you need voices you trust to unpack the big stories and ask the right questions. I'm Carrington Clark, host of the new podcast, ABC Business Daily. Monday to Thursday, we take the big business stories and break them down. What happened? Why it happened? Who it helps? Who it hurts? Search for ABC Business Daily on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
As the battle for control of the Strait of Hormuz continues,
Lebanon continues to sustain attacks from the Israeli Defence Force.
Right now, villages are being destroyed and over a million people are displaced.
So what is Benjamin Netanyahu's endgame? Could Lebanon be the sticking point in bringing the war in Iran to a close?
And is Israel trying to sabotage any peace deal with Iran? I'm Latika Burke.
And I'm Laura Tingle, joining the program this week.
Today, we're going roaming to Beirut. Well, we've got a new voice joining us on Global Roaming, Laura Tingle. Welcome. How are you?
Latika Burke, it's been a long time, so it's very good
to be here. I know. And the world, of course, the chaos in the world just does not stop. Just as we thought a ceasefire had been brokered between Iran and the United States by Pakistan last week, along comes a new bout of conflict. And that, of course, is the strikes that Israel conducts on Lebanon, which had everybody gripping the table, thinking perhaps this might break the ultimate ceasefire that everyone had been waiting for. I'm extremely interested to learn today and delve into exactly the motivations behind this. Was it an attempt to sabotage the entire ceasefire? Is Netanyahu after perpetual war? And what, more importantly, is the feeling in Lebanon on the ground about how all of this continues to affect the poor, suffering and displaced peoples of Lebanon?
Well, absolutely. An extraordinary story in itself, what's been happening in Lebanon in recent weeks. And, you know, with a million people displaced, huge sections of southern Lebanon now being razed as Gaza was previously, members of the Netanyahu government talking about occupying essentially 10% of the Lebanese landmass, you know, indefinitely. And the complexities of the Lebanese government structure and Hezbollah. So we're going to be joined by Heiko Wimmen, who's the International Crisis Group's project director for Iraq, Syria and Lebanon, who's lived in Beirut for the past 29 years. And it'll be interesting to see what he can tell us about what it feels like in Beirut and what his reading is on what's happening there at the moment and exactly what Israel is up to.
Here he is now.
Heiko, welcome. Could you first give us an idea of what life in Beirut is like right now?
Well, it's live on the edge, or maybe live in the limbo. You know that on Wednesday we had this terrible wave of strikes right in the center of town and without prior warning in places where people did not expect them. And that's still like everybody's still reeling from that. It rattled everybody. Now, since this so-called ceasefire has taken hold between the Iranians and the Americans, things have returned to somewhat to normal, right? I mean, so the ceasefire was on Wednesday. Netanyahu took the chance to do this wave of strikes in the immediate aftermath amidst some ambiguity whether that ceasefire applied here or not, here in Lebanon or not as well. And then, as we now know, he got probably rather strong messaging from Washington that he should, at least for now, cool it. On Friday, there was a conference call between the Lebanese ambassador to the U.S., the Israeli ambassador to the U.S., and the U.S. ambassador to Lebanon. And they agreed to have an in-person meeting at the State Department to talk ceasefire here. So So things have calmed down, but in the south, they're still fighting. In the south, the Israelis are still attacking. Hezbollah is still attacking. The Israelis are still making threatening noises. The Minister of Energy, it seems, has said now more than once that Israel would need to hit Lebanese infrastructure, even the airport. So it's a very uneasy, very relative calm.
Heiko, was it a shock when the ceasefire was announced and Israel began targeting Lebanon? Did that come as a surprise to Lebanon?
Yes and no. I mean, obviously, once the ceasefire was announced between the Americans and the Iranians, we all hoped, okay, the worst is hopefully over. But at the same time, the Israelis had messaged before consistently that a ceasefire with Iran will not apply here. And that rather, and there was the expectation that, okay, once they're done with the Iranians, once their air force is no longer needed to run bombing attacks in Iran or assist the Americans there, then they would turn their wrath, the full weight of their wrath on us. So people, to some extent, people expected that something like that might happen. But of course, I mean, it was still a shock then that it came that quickly and that fiercely in areas where before there were no attacks, in areas where people felt safe against buildings that were full of civilians who were not even clear that there was somebody worth targeting in these buildings, or if this was indeed, again, the Israeli AI deciding that perhaps somebody could be at certain times in this building, so let's just bring it down. That definitely was a shock that it went that far.
What do we know about those targets, Heiko? There's been speculation that the Israelis had set up the targets based on the IP addresses of Hezbollah fighters in various buildings, but it seems to have been an incredibly clumsy attack. What's the discussion in Lebanon about what provoked those particular attacks on those particular sites?
I mean, look, after this thing with the pagers, this attack with the pagers a year and a half ago, everything seems possible, you know, and the expectation is that Israeli surveillance is everywhere and they know everybody's movings about. It seems credible, but that's not really the discussion here, as far as I can see. I mean, the discussion is very much about the fear and perhaps the fact that at least some Hezbollah may be hiding among completely uninvolved people. I mean, there was an attack a few days before that in an area that is absolutely not identified with Hezbollah, in a predominantly Christian area, that actually killed a Christian politician, and it later emerged that that was a narrow miss, so to speak. You know, that there was indeed somebody in the building who was linked to Hezbollah, was just not there at the very moment. Plus, they hit the wrong target. They hit the third floor while the target should have been on the fourth floor. So, you know, like, and the discussion is mostly that about the fear and to the extent that we believe it's the case, the indignation or the resentment that Hezbollah would do that and expose people to these attacks.
Heiko, this seems like a good time to just stock take. What is the relationship now between Hezbollah and the Lebanese government?
So as you know, Hezbollah is actually part of the government. They have two ministers in the government who are, I believe, not formally members of the party, but everybody knows they're on the party's behalf. There are another two ministers that belong to Hezbollah's very close ally, the Amal movement. So they're in the government. They have stayed in the government, even though the government has decided to actually outlaw Hezbollah's military activities, outlaw their military structures, but they're still in the government. They haven't left the government. And the party has completely ignored this decision. And now, like, as the government is like moving towards these negotiations with the Israelis, as well as like up the ante rhetorically, they have, when the government outlawed their military activities, already threatened that if the government were to actually act on that, actually move security forces against them, arrest Hezbollah, cadres and whatnot, that they may even overthrow the government in that case. And they have threatened that they now have renewed those threats. And in general, for the longest time, the relationship was that Hezbollah would go through the motions of seeking consensus, go through the motions of complying with what the government said it was going to do in terms of disarmament, in terms of implementing the ceasefire, and while doing in the reality doing something else, you know, so comply on the surface, but rebuild and rearm in reality, and that pretense has been dropped. They're no longer pretending that they're cooperating with the government.
I suppose that raises the million-dollar question in this, which is, what's the point of the US? Of the Israeli government negotiating with the Lebanese government? I mean, it doesn't seem to have any sway over Hezbollah, which is who the Israelis are actually fighting. What role does the Lebanese government actually play in Lebanon if it doesn't have any capacity to control Hezbollah?
Well, that is a $1 million question that many Lebanese are asking as well. What's the value of this government if it can't actually do what it has declared it wants to do, right? I mean, the president, there was a new president elected a year and a half ago. The government came in. They said very explicitly and very adamantly that they want to impose a monopoly on force and of course on decisions related to armed force, like decisions of war and peace. And they have not been able to go through with that. So those negotiations, indeed, that question is very pertinent. Why this even discuss with a government that is so obviously unable to then implement whatever it may or may not agree to, right? You know, so, and it has always been the case that Lebanese governments are, a mosaic, a hodgepodge of political forces that are often very much opposed, that they kind of cobble together majorities and take decisions in that basically have to bring together like sometimes polar opposites, which often meant that these decisions were meaningless and empty. That is really the crux of pretty much, I would say, any political system that's built on consensus, right, and not on majority decisions. And that's how the Lebanese system is constructed. And it is, of course, a very problematic and indeed destructive setup if you have really polar divisions in not only in politics, but only in also in society about existential questions, you know. So should you go to war with Israel? Should you be an ally of Iran?
Heiko, what is the domestic sentiment around these questions? How much support is there for Hezbollah? And has Israel's strikes changed that equilibrium in any way?
That's another million-dollar question, of course. Look, I mean, there's clearly a very large part of the Lebanese society, I would argue probably a solid majority, that was very much against Hezbollah joining this war. Because from that perspective, Hezbollah is sacrificing Lebanon on the altar of the survival of the Iranian regime. So that's the majority of the Lebanese, most of the Christians, most of the Sunnis, and basically all except for the Shiite community. It all, in the end, pretty much aligns by sect and confession and religion. Now, if you look at the Shiite community, I mean, there was a lot was to hear. We could hear a lot of also their indignation in the beginning. I mean, these people are being displaced a second time in less than 2 years. Their homes destroyed again. You know, I mean, they're homeless again, and they also feel like they are becoming something like pariahs in society. You know, like, I mean, one thing is that people are afraid that, you know, like taking them in may actually draw Israeli attacks because Hezbollah people may be hiding among them. People may have relatives who are Hezbollah and come visit them and things like that. But also there are a lot of people are collectively blaming the community. You are the ones who've been voting Hezbollah time and again into parliament. You are the one who's supporting them. You are the one who's giving them the popular support for all these attacks. You brought this upon us. And that's the flip side, you know, by feeling collectively targeted by the Israelis, but also collectively like blamed by the Lebanese. I mean, there's the sense that the community is basically once more rallying behind the party more than they certainly did at the beginning. It's something that you have in almost any counterinsurgency or any insurgency situation, is if like the collective, the community from where the insurgency emerges is punished collectively, it will serve the insurgent party that conducts the fight.
You're listening to Global Roaming on ABC Radio National with me, Latika Berg, and Laura Tingle. Today we're joined by Heiko Women from the International Crisis Group based in Beirut.
So what realistically can we expect to see out of these conversations in Washington? I mean, is there anything that could happen? And what are also the expectations about the question of where Israel's going to establish its borders? I mean, are people expecting that they're going to basically occupy Lebanon up into the Litani River indefinitely now?
Yeah, that is pretty much the expectation. Look, I think it's not realistic to imagine that these talks in Washington can lead to any significant results as long as the issue with Iran has not been resolved, right? You know, I mean, Hezbollah joined this fight explicitly in solidarity to support Iran. They will not stand down. They will not disarm unless Iran decides that it's in the interest of the Iranian regime for Hezbollah to stand down and disarm. You know? And that, of course, requires a much larger understanding about like how the security in the region should look like, which we don't really expect from these talks in Islamabad or what may follow them after the failure of the first round. We don't really accept that this can yield this kind of understanding anytime soon. So I think the maximum, the best we can hope for from the talk is like some sort of agreement that we will return to a variation of the ceasefire that has existed between November 24 and now, and March 2nd of 26. You know, which is, as you may know, was a very one-sided ceasefire, right? I mean, Hezbollah would cease fire and Israel would still target Hezbollah cadres and alleged assets. And I think the Israelis, yes, will establish the security zone. Not sure if they will occupy Lebanon up to the Litani. They'll probably occupy, that's the general expectation, a strip of like 10 kilometers deep into Lebanese territory that will remove northern Israel communities from the threat of direct fire by anti-tank missiles, against which there's no real defense. And then another layer to basically be a no-go zone. You know? It's like anybody who's anything hostile in these areas, which is probably going to be anything and anybody, will be targeted. And that probably will lead up to the Litani and a bit above it, beyond it in some places. But there's some places where the Litani River is very close to the border. So then Mr. Netanyahu can declare victory in the sense that he has improved the security of northern Israel for significantly, degraded Hezbollah somewhat, you know, and then basically say, okay, if the Lebanese want to get back these territories, they'll have to do something about Hezbollah, and until then we'll keep them. You know? So I think this is the most plausible outcome at this point. And a significant change or development towards a durable solution is only imaginable if the issue with Iran is solved.
Can I ask about the displacement? I mean, how is Lebanon coping with the suffering that this is causing?
By the numbers we have, there's more than 1 million of Lebanese who have been displaced. Only about 10% of these displaced are in public shelters, public schools and other public buildings. A lot of it is very makeshift. The big majority of these people have found accommodation somewhere by their own means and their own strength. And I suppose many people now get support from relatives abroad in this extreme situation. So overall, the coping is, for now, relatively good. You see a few people camping on public land. It's like, compared to the numbers that we hear, it's really not that much. You know? But of course, this is not a sustainable setup. You know, I mean, these people not only lost their homes, they lost their businesses, they lost their source of income with the displacement in most cases, whether it was agricultural land or shops or work in factories. I mean, I'm personally, my favorite branch of juice is no longer in the market because the factory is an area that you can't access. Maybe there's even been a time, you know. So that means a couple of dozen, maybe 100 people are out of a job, right? You know, so all of this is not sustainable in the long run. That's the first problem. And the second problem is that if the Israelis really establish the security zone the way we now expect and what they say they intend to do, then this displacement for probably as much as half of these people, that's 600,000, which is like more than 10% of the population, the displacement will become permanent. And that, of course, is a massive demographic shift. It changes the demographic composition, the sectarian religious composition of many areas, which is a very sensitive topic in Lebanon. And it's a recipe for more tension in a situation where already the tensions are very high between parties, but also between communities who's responsible for this war, who brought this calamity upon us, and so on and so forth. So this doesn't bode well for the immediate future.
It doesn't. And I suppose summing up finally, Heiko, essentially, you know, it's a very bleak picture for the people of Lebanon and for what these ceasefire talks might produce. What's your expectation that Lebanon is going to be the real stumbling block for a ceasefire between Iran and the US?
I don't really expect Lebanon to be the stumbling block for Iranian-American negotiations or a ceasefire. I mean, there are enormous economic interests involved. I mean, there's I think we're looking, if this problem about Hormuz is not resolved in the near future, I mean, we're looking at enormous economic losses globally. And there's the nuclear issue as well. That is another that has been the center of attention. I don't really think that whatever kind of deal in the end, and even it's only a tacit, an informal deal, but whatever kind of way to at least mitigate this crisis and this pressure, economic pressure, but also to deal with the nuclear file, whatever is found there, I don't think will hinge upon the problem in Lebanon being resolved. I mean, there was this idea that Netanyahu wanted to sabotage the ceasefire by these attacks last Wednesday. I mean, I don't know if, I'm not sure if that was the intention. I don't really see that. In the end, American, but also international interest in hedging in the fallout of this crisis will prevail over whatever calculations Mr. Netanyahu may have. And I think even from the Israeli perspective, I mean, Iran remains the center of the problem, or the head of the octopus, as they themselves describe it, you know. So I don't think the Israelis would want to sabotage a solution with Iran or some kind of arrangement with Iran that serves their interests. I don't think they will sabotage or pass that up over Lebanon.
Heiko Uyman, thanks so much for your insights from Beirut, and hopefully it stays quiet there from now on.
I hope so. I hope my son can go back to school tomorrow, because right now he's been on, there was a school break, you know, until today, and tomorrow he's supposed to go back. I really like to have that kid some real school again, and not some stupid online. Have him be able to play with his friends, you know, and not be stuck in a house, you know, with nothing to do. I mean, the war started pretty much shortly before the vacation started. You know, the school took about a week to get, almost a week to get online working somewhat. You know, and it was still pretty much of a joke. And, you know, and they were not really much concerned about it, I feel, because the vacation was upon us. You know, so now I think they'll have to find a more durable solution for this. So people, me included, will start taking their kids out and put them in schools in different areas. The Israelis have been also without schools for 5 weeks. I mean, my colleague there, you know, like just said, yeah, that last week when the ceasefire came, you know, like, so Israelis have been sitting in bunkers for 5 weeks, no sleep, no school, you know, to reopen the Straits of Hormuz that were open before the war, and to set back Iran's armament by probably not much more than those 5 weeks. You know, so, I mean, a bit exaggerated perhaps, but I think it reflects the resentment that some people over there also have.
It's those tiny insights that bring it home. Thanks for joining us, Heiko.
Thanks once again. So, Latika, a pretty bleak picture from Heiko Wimmen about both what it's like in Beirut and Lebanon in general and about the prospects for anything substantial coming out of these talks this week.
Yes, there was a sense of helplessness and hopelessness almost there, wasn't there? And this idea that what's it all for? What's the bigger grand strategic prize that Netanyahu gets from all of this? I thought this comment he said at the end there about the resentment being on both sides, it's not something that we've tapped into much as we've looked at this issue so much from what's going on at leader level. And I think that's why it's particularly important to hear from someone like Heiko just about how ordinary people are also interpreting these events on the ground.
Yes, that whole confusing picture of the role of Hezbollah in Lebanese society, the fact that, yes, they've got a lot of support, but, you know, a million people are displaced as a result of the conflict with Israel, and it seems intractable. They've got a Lebanese government, which nobody thinks is very useful for anything, but on the other hand, you've got Hezbollah, which is just making them all a target. And you do wonder, with all of those people displaced and moving to the north, as he says, a changing demographic mix in the cities and in parts of Beirut, it's not going to get any better anytime soon, is it?
Well, it certainly gives Netanyahu a strong hand, doesn't it? For as long as the United States enables or allows him to continue striking, he does, in a sense, have free rein, doesn't he?
Totally. But once again, very interesting that he didn't think that Netanyahu's plan here was to attack Beirut purely to disrupt the ceasefire between Iran and the US, that it was basically him being opportunistic while everybody was otherwise occupied. He'd just give them a real whacking while people were otherwise discussing trying to sort of stop wars in other parts of the region. So an interesting conversation.
Now, don't forget to write to us. We love your feedback, questions, suggestions, ideas. Keep them all coming. We read them all. Our email is global.roaming@abc.net.au.
Thanks to our producer on this episode, Aston Brown, and our executive producer, Kylie Gray. Geraldine and Latika will be back tomorrow with more on the Middle East conflict and its implications for China. They'll be joined by British political scientist Rana Mitter.
Yes, looking forward to that one. See you next time, Laura.
Looking forward to it, Latika. Goodbye.
Hey, I'm Sana Qadar, and I host All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. It's a show where we investigate why people behave the way they do. But there's some perspectives we don't often hear about, like what makes people cross the line into criminal behavior?
Are they evil or are they damaged? Are they both?
Join me for Criminal Psychology, a special series diving into some of these questions. Hear it now on the ABC Listen app.